All right, so announcements, homework B1 solutions are available on Canvas. Because there was a with random numbers worked out, there were two simultaneous events that happened at the exact same time at the end time, which was, I guess, a little more challenging. So I went through, I actually pulled the grader to be a little generous on the final row of the sims, because there are a bunch of sort of different choices I can understand on right, so ambiguity, because that's kind of a special case. The simultaneous events and the simultaneous events with it into them. I already went through and kind of pre-graded a lot of these, and so when the grades get released, you'll see some comments from me on anyone who might have tripped up on there. Just so you know that when there are simultaneous events, you can let it all in one line rather than creating multiple lines. And although we sort things by time, we also, like, because everything that happens at one time sort of assumed to happen collectively, like all together, then it with an end event, you kind of think of it as being sorted sort of later in the list. And so if you get an arrival, departure, and an end all at the same time, then at the time of the end event, you process the arrival and departure. The order of those don't really matter, but then you also then after that, then process the end. So there were some students that just saw the end and they just processed the end and they left the arrival and departure at that same time on the queue when you're looking for the other way around. But I realized that was kind of a special case. It was a little tricky. It was just how a random number that I generated worked out. It didn't happen to notice, but I gave you a little bit more challenging case for that one when I generated it. So that, you know, again, I've asked the graders to sort of be a little more generous and I gave a kind of policy for that. So hopefully did that. I think some people got it. And so that's great. It's like, I want to award those people, you know, credit for getting it, you know, totally right. And then, but for others who might get tripped up for it, I don't want to penalize too much for it. So that's homework B1. And there's other kind of Canvas activity. Homework C2 is available. I'll be releasing the next homework as well. And that'll be the last homework before the midterm. But homework C2 is available on Canvas. It's I say it's due in 1 week, Julia, really, and due next week. So it's due the Saturday after lecture D2. So today, Tuesday, we're going to be finishing up unit C this week, and then we'll have unit D next week, and this will be due at the end of next week. So in order to make sure I get all the solutions out to you before the midterm availability opens up, that's one of the reasons why I make the homework to do on Saturdays, even though the labs are due on Sundays. I mean, everybody seemed to get their stuff in on Saturdays, but I think there was only saying one or two students that were a little confused by that. So just it's in order to sort of get the timing right for the midterm so that I can give you, because what I'm actually going to do with the midterm, which we'll talk about later, is I'm going to give you more than a day of availability for stage one. So you'll be able to sort of, you know, do it Monday, Tuesday, or maybe Wednesday. And so in order for everybody to have those solution sets available on that Sunday before that Monday, I have to have all the homework in on Saturday. So it's kind of that's dynamic programming thing where in order to get everything working by the midterm, it ends up making the homework due on Saturdays for everything before. So that's why we've got that. But so just highlighting that again, that this homework will be due this Saturday, not this Saturday, but Saturday for next week. A little book reading might be required for this one. Again, to try to get you as many solution sets and available before the midterm, then I kind of accelerated or had a little bit of overlap between kind of the C2 period and the next homework period, but not that much. And so basically, the material to do C2 is we're going to cover on lectures E1 and E2, and E2 is technically after C2 is due. It's very minor reading in order to, it's basically plug and shove in order to figure out the right method for these. And of course, you can look forward to these lectures too. They're all online. So that's this next homework coming up. Any questions about the assignment stuff? We'll talk more about the midterm schedule when we get a little closer. And then, of course, again, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but the Rockwell Arena competition closes at the end of the month, those who are interested. So, no questions then. All right, then I'm going to switch to a little post lab from lab three.
Before then, I switched to the rest of today. So a little bit of a change in order. So just give me a second to switch over to that one. Okay. All right. So you just finished this lab three on Monte Carlo methods. So I just want to highlight a few things about results here that will help us as we think about after the midterm as well. So what we did here in lab three is introduce you, or some of you at least, to Monte Carlo methods. And one, example of a popular example of what we can do with Monte Carlo methods is estimate the value of pi, which it actually, I don't know if you noticed, but today is what, 9, 16, 25, so three perfect squares, but it's also 3, 4, 5, it's a Pythagorean triple. So this is, so 9 plus 16 equals 25, 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. That's probably the only time in your life you can experience a day with the Pythagorean triple proper. So enjoy it. That's kind of related to this estimating pi. So the idea here is that rather than estimating pi by measuring a circumference and dividing by diameter, or using a Taylor series expansion or all of these other methods, one of the things we can do is randomly throw dots at a space and calculate how many of those dots fall inside a circle. And if you know how many dots fall inside a circle versus how many dots fall outside a circle, that number is a number which is predicted by pi. And so by estimating that number to a very fine precision, then you're effectively estimating pi. So the way the story goes is that the probability that a random dot lands inside the circle is going to be the area of the circle divided by the total area. Well, the area of a circle is pi r squared. The total area is 2r squared. So you do pi r squared divided by the quantity, 2r squared, and you get pi over 4. So if you can estimate the number of dots in the circle versus the total number of dots, that ratio is an estimate of pi over 4. Multiply it by 4, you get an estimate of pi. That's a common Monte Carlo method for estimating pi. We can simplify it a little bit by focusing on just the top corner. And if we just look at the top corner, then the area of the top corner here is pi r squared over 4. The bottom here is r squared. But what's nice about this is that now when we throw these marbles or darts at this board, then we just need to draw two random numbers, one random number uniformly distributed between 0 and 1, the other random number uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. Those between become our coordinates. And then we say, for these two coordinates that we drew, how many are inside the circle, how many are outside the circle. And that ratio gives us an estimate of pi over 4, which we then multiply by 4 to give us an estimate of pi. So this is really nice because it's easy to calculate whether something's inside a unit circle. You just square both coordinates, add them together, see if they're less than 1. Thus, my comment today about today's date being a Pythagorean triple. So there's this, you can do that in a spreadsheet. So we generate, Excel happens to have a function RAM, which draws a number between 0 and 1. So you draw two of them, and in every row, you eventually get a coordinate. So that's a dart, you throw it at a dart board. And then for each one of those, you're saying, for this dart, did it happen to land inside the circle or outside the circle? And I get a bunch of ones and zeros. And if I average that column, then that average will be an estimate of pi over 4. So if I take 4 times that average, then I get an estimate of pi. That's an example of a Monte Carlo method for estimating pi, just by throwing random darts at things. There are other methods like that. If we did the lab lecture, I talked about the Fock needle, which is an approach where you throw a bunch of toothpicks onto a picnic table. And you see how many toothpicks happen to straddle some of the gaps between the boards of the picnic table. And if you count how often that happens, it turns out that is also predicted by a formula that has a pi in it. And so then by that, you know, estimating that quantity and then solving for pi, you get an estimate of pi. So lots of ways of just using random numbers to estimate these quantities. That's, a Monte Carlo. Now, if we think about it, you could ask, well, how many marbles or toothpicks do I have to throw? So I can say, well, if I do 500 marbles thrown into the dartboard, and I take an average, I get some average here. But if I know that if I do a different 500 marbles, I'm going to get a slightly different average. And another 500 marbles will give me a slightly different average. So I can now study the standard deviation of averages. And this is something that we'll talk about after the semester, but hopefully review. That's the so-called standard error of the mean, or SEM. And so this bar here shows me that for this estimate, I also estimate the standard deviation of estimates, the standard error of the mean. So this is the standard deviation of some underlying distribution, this of pi. This is a standard deviation of my estimate of pi. And so it's saying that, if you run this experiment over and over again, sometimes you'll estimate pi to be up here, sometimes you'll estimate pi to be up here. It's normally going to be around here, but our estimate of the variance of that distribution allows for the distribution to sort of one SD away in terms of estimates, not some other distribution. So it's the standard error of the mean. It's different than the standard deviation. And so what we see is if we increase the number of samples, the standard error of the mean gets narrower and narrower and narrower. So from this experiment to this experiment, the actual estimate changes, but also the uncertainty around the estimate. So as we'll talk about after the midterm, we can take these standard estimates, standard error means, and combine them with the t-test to create the confidence interval. And so that's what a confidence interval is, as we'll learn in after the midterm. A confidence interval are all of the hypotheses that you cannot reject at 1 minus the confidence interval's percentage. So these are 95% confidence intervals. And so what this is saying is that I have based on these data, I would like to test the hypothesis that pi is, let's say, 3. Well, 3 is outside all of these confidence intervals, which means I reject the hypothesis that pi is 3. But the confidence interval says if I do 500 samples, that anything in this interval is not able to be rejected by a t-test at an estimate for pi. And so what we see is I go from 500 samples to 1,000 samples to 10,000 and so on. Notice the confidence intervals get shrink, but they all happen to include the real value of pi. And so only 5% of the time will they fail to include the real value of pi. That's our type 1 error. So that's how type 1 error looks when you plot it as confidence interval. So whenever people talk about confidence intervals, they're behind the scenes talking about t-tests. And so, I just think it's kind of a nice result. You see that as I increase the number of samples, the precision of my estimate gets better and better and better. But for all of the precisions, then if I calculate the confidence interval, then I can be confident that the real value is within that interval. So when you tell someone a confidence interval, you say, I have no idea what the real value is, but it's probably in this interval. So what we're going to try to do in this class, and we need to keep this in mind, is move from point estimate thinking to integral estimate thinking. By the end of this class, you should never, ever give me a point estimate. You give me data, I don't care what the sample average is of that data. It's meaningless, which is ironic because it's a mean. But the interval is what I care about. Because what you're trying to say is estimate the population mean. I want to estimate pi. Well, none of these means of my data are pi. But pi is included in all of these intervals. So if you give me the interval, it tells me that, well, I know what pi isn't. Pi isn't 3, and it's not 3.35. What is pi? Well, all you can say is, I'm not quite sure what the value of pi is, but it's probably within this interval. If you want a tighter interval than that, you're going to have to give me more simulation budget, and then I'll run more sims, and then I can tighten it up for you. So if you give me a lot of computing power, then I can estimate things down to this confidence interval. Still, I'm not going to be able to give you an exact value of pi, but I can exclude a lot more other values. So that's really what we're doing when we're adding more samples. We're excluding more options, making our list of possibilities smaller and smaller and smaller, where we'll never, ever be able to collapse it to a single point. And so that's why we don't ever want to give stakeholders the impression that we know something down to a point estimate. Point estimates are for other disciplines. For engineering, science, it's all about internal estimates. Questions about that, about this interpretation? Okay. You know, I mentioned already that a tool that you can use in a spreadsheet program, Google Sheets, Excel, RAND, that draws a uniformly distributed number between 0 and 1. And so that's what we mean when we say random number. So when we say random number, that is only this. So if you say, oh, I drew random numbers, well, that means that it's exactly this, uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. If I say random variance, then that could mean anything. But random number means exactly this. And we'll talk about that more as we move on. Before the interview. So then in the lab, I had to do this the stochastic activity network. And so we said there's these multiple activities and they're all pooling into a single activity. So that single activity can't end until all three of these activities end. And one activity has three subparts, the other activity has two subparts, the other activity has only one part. They all have the same mean. They all have a 9-minute average. But they have different distributions because of how this timing is broken up. And this has to do with independence and correlation. So if you have a three-part activity, then as we talked about last time, then it is very unlikely if these are three independent activities or three independent subparts that all three will be at either extreme simultaneously. It's just very unlikely that you'll be lucky enough to get a two-minute, all simultaneous. And as a consequence, it in light of us can be very likely to get a 4, 4, and 4. And as a consequence, the more independent things you add, even if you maintain the same average, you're going to make extreme events less and less and less likely. Because extreme events of a sum require simultaneous extreme events of everything you're adding. That's the central limit theorem, and that's what we see in this exercise. So, how you did this is, you calculated 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 random variables. So you calculated 6 of those, 6 uniformly distributed between 2 and 4, 2 and 4, 2 and 4. 2 between 3 and 6, 3 and 6, and 1 between 6 and 12. Calculated all 6 of those variants. And that was your total activity. So then from those, you could say, if I add these 3 together, that gives me my 3-part duration. If I add these 2 together, that gives me my 2-part duration. And then my 1-part duration is just done right there. So for each row, then I can see what's the max. So in this case, it happened to be the 2-part duration. And then I can then ask, so which path was it? And like I said, in this case, it's the 2-part one. So I've now got a list of total activity durations and a list of what the critical path was. And so you can then analyze these using histograms or some other tools and get hopefully something that looks a little like this. So in the durations here, remember the average duration of all 3 paths was 9 minutes. And yet, the average duration of the total activity is up here at 10 minutes, and it's got a lot of mass above 9 minutes. So what's going on there? Well, if we go down and look at the critical paths, then we see that path 3 is 41% of the time the critical path. It takes the longest. So in this case, path 3 was the 1 activity path. And then path 2, 30% of the time, and path 1, 29% of the time. So what this is telling us is that there's not the symmetry that we expected across these things, that Third path, the one that is just a single activity, often takes the longest. And so what we're seeing here when we take a max across these three activities is that we're seeing that it is, you get a, there's a reasonable probability that you're going to get times above 9 minutes for this third path. In the rare times when the times are under 9 minutes for this third path, then you have to be lucky enough that neither of these two are above 9 minutes. So overall, it's going to be less likely, like in order to for you to get a total duration less than 9 minutes, a lot has got to happen simultaneously. And so you have to, you know, get very lucky. And so that's the reason why most of the durations are well above 9 minutes. Okay, so if we want to drill down into that a little farther, we could say, well, you know, that was with 500 runs. We do it with 1,000 runs. Distribution gets a little smoother, but it's basically the same distribution. 10 or 100,000 runs, it's very smooth, but still basically the same distribution. And now we get more precise estimates of these proportions. But like you can see, it's still the they still have this pattern that this one very rarely takes the longest. This one sometimes takes the longest. This one very often takes the longest. So those are the results that you should have gotten. And they were driven by these path duration distributions. So this is the duration that often takes the longest is the uniform distribution. The one that has two activities has this triangular distribution. That triangle is what you get when you add two uniforms together. That's the so-called convolution of two uniform distributions, is a triangular distribution. When you add independent things together, you convolve their probability distributions. And so that's why you go from being a box to being a triangle. And then if you add three of them together, you've got now three things convolved together, it smooths out even more, and you get this thing that starts looking like a bell. So you are seeing the central limit theorem happening here. Is that as you add more things together, then very quickly it becomes bell-shaped. And so very quickly we can approximate additive things by normal distributions. This is why when you start modeling things that are out in the real world, when if you have a sequence, like let's say you're modeling a process of putting a burrito together at Chipotle, you could model every individual operation, right? To unroll the tortilla, to put things in the tortilla, to do all these different things. But each one of those stations is independent of the other station. They just add the sequence together. And so because all of those stations, there's very little weighting between those stations, they flow from one to the other to the other, you can often model the whole process as an additive process. And it will most likely be a normal distribution. You have to figure out the mean and the variance. But that mean and the variance, that normal, is going to be powerful enough to model most additive things in nature. And it's all because of this property of that when you add these independent things together, it's unlikely for you to see simultaneous extreme events, and that creates bell curves. And that's why we see so many bell curves in nature, because so many things are additive and independent. All right, questions about that? Something we'll drill down into a lot more after the midterm. A little bit. Okay. So yeah, three uniforms, two uniforms, one. All right. The other thing that I hope you picked up in this lab is, you know, you sometimes do have to generate uniformly distributed random numbers, random variance between A and B, where A and B are not 0 and 1. But all Excel gives you is the ability to generate them between 0 and 1. So what do? Well, you have a little formula where if you you take the range you want, so you say, I want these to be distributed over a 10-number range. Well, let me just say, well, I'll get the 0, 1, 1 and scale it up by 10. But then I'll shift it over by A, and then I'll have a uniform distribution between A and B. That's the idea here. So that's how I get my random variance from my random number when it's also uniformly distributed. So we can transform one type of randomness into another. This is the same thing that happens when you play board games and all you have is a die, And that die is that uniformly distributed outcomes across all of its faces. But when you roll it, you pick up a card, and that card says, if you roll 1 to 6, this is the outcome. If you roll 7 to 8, this is the outcome. If you roll 9, this is the outcome. What they're doing there is creating a function that maps one form of randomness to another form of randomness. And that's what we do here. And that's what we're going to start doing in that upcoming homework. And in next week, we're going to start looking at how do we generate one form of randomness, and then how do we use mathematics to transform them into another form of randomness so that we can model all of the processes that we see in the world that aren't going to look like a random. Because all Excel is going to give us is random. All MATLAB is going to give us is random. There are they sometimes do this process for us, but underneath the scenes, they're doing transformations like this. The only thing that they fundamentally have access to is the random number, the uniform distribution between 0 and 1. So we have to learn how to transform that into any other randomness that's fine. That's what we're going to be doing real soon. So, examples of that you saw in your lab brief, which is meant to tee us up for next week and the week after, is these probability distributions. You said we have 3 different outcomes here that we would like to simulate. These are the probabilities we'd like to simulate them with. So outcome 2 is half the time, and then you get things split between outcome 1 and 3 the rest of the time. So how do we do that when all we have access to is that random number generator, which generates numbers from 0 and 1? That generates a continuous number from 0 and 1. We just want 3 outcomes. This is identical to saying I have a 20-sided die in a board game, but I only want 3 things to happen, like 3 possible things to happen. I just want to adjust the probabilities. And I'm going to say I'm going to a symbol, some size of that die, and put that into 1 outcome. Other side of the die, the other outcome. Another side of the die, the other outcome. That allows me to balance the probabilities of those 3 outcomes using my 20 outcomes in my 20-sided die. So that's what we're going to do, a more sophisticated version of that. So how do we start on that? Well, what we can say is, if you draw a RAND from Excel or from MATLAB or wherever, then there's this nice feature, is that the probability that the number that Excel gives you is less than 22 happens to be 20%. The probability that that number that Excel gives you is less than 0.7 happens to be 70%. The probability that the number that Excel or MATLAB or whatever gives you is between 0.2 and 0.7 is the difference between 0.7 and 0.2, 50%. So this is a really convenient way for us to set up discrete outcomes. And what we can do is we can say, okay, this is great. If I draw a random number, if it's between 0 and 0.2, I'm going to call that outcome 1. And I know that will occur 20% of the time, which is exactly what I wanted. If it happens to be between 0.2 and 0.7, well, there's 0.5 between those. So that outcome, I'll call outcome 2, will happen 50% of the time. And if that random number that comes out of Excel or MATLAB is between 0.7 and 1, then that's outcome 3, and that will happen 30% of the time. Because I know when you draw a random number, it will be between 1.0 and 0.7, 0.3. times, or 0.3 of the time, 30% of the time. So that is how I get that. That's, and so I can generalize. Any questions about this? Or build on this? So I can, if I take these probabilities and I turn them into cumulative probabilities, so this is why for the rest of the class, we're going to be obsessed with cumulative distribution functions, not probability mass functions, not density functions. Cumulative, we're going to learn to look at data as a cumulative distribution function. And these CDFs are just so much more mathematically friendly. So remember, a CDF is, you take your, for this outcome, you just pull its cumulative probability straight down. For this outcome, you add this probability to this probability to get that one. For this outcome, you add this probability to the previous cumulative to get that one. So all cumulative probabilities end in 1.0, and they generally start with whatever probability was in the lowest outcome. So we have this cumulative probability distribution, and so with that, we can actually use these as our boundaries to put into this mapping for our roll the dice mapping of how we get the three outcomes that we want. Is that if we look up to these things, we can say, anything from negative infinity, basically from zero to this first boundary, is going to map to that one. Anything between these two boundaries will map to that one. Anything between these two boundaries will map to that. So for any discrete distribution where you've got probabilities for every outcome, you calculate its cumulative distribution, and that tells you the offense posts where you just compare your drawn random number to, and it'll tell you, for this random number, which outcome should I draw? And that's what we see down here. So that's what we can do in a table, which we've experimented with a little bit in lab three. You have a probability, you have a set of outcomes, you have probabilities to calculate their cumulatives. And so in every row, you draw a single, this is really important, a single random number. You don't reuse RAND across the row. You draw it once, and then that draw you then use in your formula. So you don't put RAND in your formulas. You put whatever is drawn by RAND, or else it'll draw multiple random numbers throughout the formula. So when you draw that number, and then you then say, is it less than the lowest one? If it is not, then if it is, then you just do the outcome from the lowest one. If it is not, then you say, is it less than the next lowest one? And if it is, then you draw that outcome. If it's not, then you keep going. And that's what we see here. So that's how we set that up. And of course, that's easier to write in Python, in MATLAB, and so on. And Arena will also give us the ability to do this. But Arena is not going to ask for the probability mass function. It's going to ask for the cumulative distribution function. So you have to learn how to think in CDFs, because that's how you specify probabilities for these simulation tools, is by their CDFs, not their DMFs. And that's something that we'll drill down even further starting kind of next week, the week after that, and then afterwards. Okay, questions about this setup, how this works, how we get the discrete outcomes at whatever probability distribution we want. So what we're going to learn about is we can generalize this to continuous distributions too. So this is a little bit of a math salad right now, so you don't have to worry too much about it, but the idea here is that we have the cumulative distribution function for any random variable, be it continuous or discrete, then we'll be able to, and we cover this in lecture E1 and E2, draw a random number. Remember, that means between 0 and 1, plug that into the inverse of the CDF. So this is like high school math, like doing inverses, or you got a function and then you have to flip y and x. You do that with probability distribution function. Remember, the CDF, its output values are always between 0 and 1. So if you turn those outputs into inputs, then those become a mapping from any random number, which is between 0 and 1, to the values of your variable. And that's what we cover in Unit E in lectures E1 and E2 that you'll experiment with in the last homework. So that is where we're heading. And it is very much building on the things you started in lab. All right, so that's our kind of lab 3 postmortem. Are there any questions about those takeaways from lab 3, things to remember moving forward? Okay. All right, so then I want to give a little bit of the rest of the lecture is a little bit of intro on topics to help us set up for lab 4 this week. So let me flip to that. Okay, so like I said, for most of the rest of the semester, we're going to be doing discrete event system simulation. We'll be often using Arena to do that, so we'll stop having to do these hand simulations. There is an article that I've got shared on Canvas about simulation in operations research. It talks about all the interesting things you can do with simulation. This has showed up in ORMS, Operations Research Management Science Today. It talks about discrete event simulation models like the ones we talked about here being used for parts, patients, vehicles, Divergent fields of manufacturing, healthcare, services settings, logistics, transportation, military operations, just to name a few. So it links to a large survey of a wide variety of DES simulation packages as well. So wondering what things can you do with the sim packages that like we start in this class. This is a great survey of the different application areas that you can use in this class. Just because of my lack of creativity, I often will bring up the same examples over and over again, coffee shops, Chipotle, I'm sure it'll come up again. But really, there are a wide range of application areas you can use these tools for. But what other tools are out there besides the ones we'll mainly focus on in this class? We mentioned them already. I would put them on this continuum from analog, realistic detail and scaling, to metaphorical, transferable insight. So what we'll be focusing on is right here in the middle. But we want to at least be aware of these other two. I've already talked a little bit about this, and so I'm not going to dwell too much on it, but I want to just make you sort of aware of where this class's main content fits within these other two. So what I'm trying to say here is that in lab four, you're going to see, where if we drill down and start, dealing with things at a much higher resolution, actually pushing agents around, as opposed to these passive entities. What does that look like? And so that is, that is the point where you actually care about heterogeneity among your agents, that this agent, when they bump into another agent, they might have a unique interaction, where that agent, when they bump into another agent, might have a completely different interaction. When you really care about all those fine scale interactions, then you have to go to an agent-based model. But if you really care more about average behavior, then you go to something like what was talked about in an IEEE 477 system dynamics modeling, where in that case, we zoom out, we think we're larger time scales, so we think just about the averages. So it's a little bit like a simulation version of some of the things you deal with in 470. So that's kind of like, we are positioned right in the middle. We want variation, but we don't necessarily think that we need to model every single little fine scale thing. Actually, you sit here in the middle. So the 477 type stuff, the system dynamics modeling, and I already sort of talked about this, but you're going to see after lab four, when you start lab five, that we're going to work in a graphical programming language inside Arena. And most of the system dynamics modeling are also, they use these graphics that are different than ours, but superficially they look similar. So they've got these stocks and flows. And so these are supposed to look like valves, and these valves adjust the flow that pours into a stock, and that changes the stock's level. It moves up and down. And whenever you draw these things, you'll set up expressions for the flow formula. And those expressions, which are going to depend upon the other stocks in the system, set up behind the scenes a little differential equation. And this differential equation behind the scenes, the computer program numerically integrates it, solves a system of differential equations, and plots the results. And that gives you the average behavior of these systems over time. So that's how these system dynamics modeling things work. And so a popular example of that is the so-called SIR model for epidemiology. Here, I mentioned this one a couple lectures ago. You've got three different stocks, the number of susceptible people, the number of infected people, the number of recovered people. And you've got flow expressions that say, how does the number of susceptible people change based on how many susceptibles and how many infecteds are out there? How does the stock of infectious people change based on the number of susceptibles and infectious people out there? How much does the number of recovered people change based on the number of infectious people out there? This is not focusing on individual level interactions. It's just based on the rough count of how many people are out there. On average, when half of your population is infected, then how quickly will the other half get infected? On average, that's what these things cover. And so you can draw those as the system dynamics models. This is the exact same model that I just showed you, but drawn in one of these graphical formats. And then in a tool like AnyLogic, which is a tool they often use in 477, you can simulate that and you get these trajectories of these three populations over time. And so that's kind of how those things work. And then on the flip side of that, going into what you're going to see in lab four, there's the agent-based model, where we really do care about the individual interactions between these different entities. So in this little sim here, which is kind of this cartoon output, there are wolves, there are sheep, there are grass. The sheep eat the grass, which makes the grass go away. The wolves eat the sheep, which make the sheep go away. If the wolves can't find sheep, that makes the wolves go away. But sheep, if there are enough sheep around, you get new sheep. If there are enough wolves around, you get new wolves. If there's some grass left over, you get new grass. So that based on these individual level interactions, you get these changes in population. So the outputs of these things look like this. So you've got population of wolves, sheep, and grass. So these three different colors in this graph down here, and you can see they're very noisy. So it gets much more kind of realistic looking because you really are modeling all those individuals. If you're modeling with a system dynamics model, you just focus on the average here. The outputs would probably look flat. But this model captures realistic variation, but it requires you to say every time a wolf is in close proximity to a sheep, what happens? Does the wolf eat the sheep? Is the wolf hungry right now? You have to keep track of all of these little details to figure out what that individual level interaction is going to be. So there's a lot to mess up because you can get a lot of those things wrong. So it has a lot of flexibility, but it also has a lot of modeling built in. But that's what we're going to be exploring in Lab 4. So I just want to give a quick intro to that to set you up for Lab 4. So ABMs are often viewed as a scientific tool, but they're moving into engineering more now as we consider more and more complex systems. So it has a long history in biology. They're known as IBMs, individual-based models. The term ABM really comes from social scientists. So biologists use these tools to understand things like fish schools, bird flocks, interactions between animals and the ecosystems around them. The social scientists use them to understand modern societies, how organizations work, how people move through organizations. Some here at ASU even use them to understand ancient civilizations. So they notice that the human that did, there's particular distributions of artifacts. They're trying to explain, how could these artifacts have coexisted or landed in a particular place? Then they'll build artificial worlds that you can run those worlds forward and see where the artificial artifacts would have landed. You look at those distributions of artifacts and see which ones better match the data we see today. And that allows them to then make an inference about what those societies might have been like in the past. So that's how people use those even in archaeology. And then there are participatory simulations where you can actually use these agent-based models almost like multiplayer games, where you have some non-player characters that are moving around and playing, but then some group of them are networked together and tied to humans. So you now can control some of the interface between humans, and then otherwise the humans control what's left over, and then you can study how humans work in these artificial worlds. And then use that to make inferences about society or plausible changes, operations in an organization, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of different ways these things are used. Engineers use a form of ABM called multi-agent systems to study things like how do I have if I have 100 robots on Mars, how might they interact with each other? So they're starting to lead into that as we get into those types of applications. You're going to see NetLogo. This is instead of Arena, this is the other software program in Lab 4. When I was a kid, we learned on Apple IIgs how to use a program called Logo that moved a little turtle around the screen. And NetLogo is based off of that. But so the idea there is you take that and then you allow it to do a lot more and you put multiple turtles in one space that allow them to interact, and that's where the net comes from. It's a network of turtles. So that's why we're going to see the term turtle go up more and more as it comes from this whole kind of educational language called Logo. And they chose Logo because this was designed originally for social scientists who had no programming background. So they wanted to choose a platform that had been demonstrated to work with people without programming background that was that was approachable, and Logo was approachable because it was designed for a very different demographic. So it looks a little childish maybe at first, but it can do a lot. It's a very powerful one. There are other alternatives. There are Python-based alternatives. There are standalone programs. Any logic that is used in 477 actually itself has an agent-based modeling behind the scenes. In 477, we just focus on the system advanced modeling, but you can flip it over into an agent-based modeling mode as well. So there's a lot of these tools. The key feature, so for our discrete event system simulation, we talk about entities, we talk about resources, and so on. There's similar vocabulary we have to talk about for agent-based modeling. So we have agents. These are our analog of entities. So, but instead of our entities getting pushed around like water flowing through a fountain, these agents make their own decisions about when to move, and how to change. And so those are the things that interact with each other in the environment. They can move every time step, or they can move in a regular time step. So you have any time scale you want. So some people, and there are people like them, there are people in Sky, for example, that combine agent-based modeling with discrete event system timing. And that speeds up the agent-based model because you can jump over time and nothing has happened. So you can create the same timing you're learning to use a DES, you can do an ABM. But generally speaking, timing is kind of up to the developer in an ABM. There are concurrent processes, so these agents are moving in parallel. So you know, sometimes they're actually implemented on hardware in parallel. So you've got this agent and this agent sharing access to a world, but they can move at the same time throughout the world, kind of a very real world sort of system. These are microscale simulations. They're spatially explicit and be extremely fine grained, very general purpose. And they often are used to validate, to test coarser grain models. So you might say, you might use build an input model based on data you gather from an agent-based model. And then that input model will then go in to your discrete event system simulation model. So you have the slow high fidelity model generates a distribution you can use for a fast discrete event system simulation model. That's how these things evolve into each other. So to give you know why this is important, there's another ORNS article that I put online called The Pedagogy of Zombies by Horio and Aerosmith, by these two up here. And this is a case study where there was a company, LMI, they're a strategic consulting firm that does work for NASA. And they often use agent-based modeling to model things having to do with commercial flights. So they're interested in how commercial airlines respond to policy scenarios. They're interested in airline decisions and how that changes, you know, how ripple effects in the industry. And they use agent-based models to do that. Now, they would invite industrial engineers and operational research and students in as interns, so summer interns, and they would find that a lot of their ORIEMS co-op and internship students had no exposure to ABM. And so they'd spend a whole summer learning how to use ABM, and they couldn't use them in an effective way. So they wanted to motivate students to learn about ABM. So they put together this competition where you design human behavioral models to maximize survival for an ensemble of Monte Carlo runs for a zombie apocalypse. So the idea here, combining Monte Carlo runs from Lab 3 with a setup of an agent-based model that's going to model the zombie apocalypse where zombies are coming into a building and humans have to hide from those zombies. So different behavioral models for how humans hide are going to have different survival problems. Now, it's a little morbid, but you know, after I heard about this, I bumped into a graduate student years afterwards, I don't know, say 7 years after, and this was when a number of school shootings were in the news, as they unfortunately often are, and he was starting to try to use engineering methods to think about architecture and how to rebuild buildings in such a world. And he was building agent-based models to maximize survivability under such an unfortunate event. And it was, he was not aware of this competition or this, this fictitious zombie apocalypse. But it was interesting to see that his methods, they were more sophisticated than in this competition, but they effectively were setting up exactly the same problem. So this sounds like kind of a silly competition, but it actually, there were people that are doing serious work doing exactly this, like trying to, but in his case, it was less about building the behavioral models, but more about building spaces that have refuges that allow for maximal survivability, which I thought was very interesting way to use these tools. So I believe this competition has still been going on at RIT. I think it's sponsored by Informs and IISE. I haven't checked into it in a long time, but it is an example where there's demand out there for people that are aware of these tools. So we don't have, so there are courses at ASU and other units where you can learn about agent-based modeling. We don't have an engineering course focused on ABM. That's why I've added this lab, just to give you an opportunity to play with ABM so that if you do ever find yourself at a company that's using them to do OR, you'll at least have, be able to hit the ground running a little bit. So by no means are we going to have ABM experts in this class, but at least have something over it. So this is the the layout of those buildings from that zombie apocalypse. They provide a map at the beginning of the competition. You let your distributed agents go, then you let the zombies go, and then you see how the agent populations decline with the population of zombies, kind of like that wolf sheep model. And then you can then compete, say, at the end of the day, how many of my agents survive versus someone else's agents. So that was that element. It's used in other places. Southwest Airlines used a lot of ABM. They had a cargo management policy, right? So you may not realize it, but every time a plane goes into the sky carrying the virtual air passengers, it has a lot of empty space in the cargo hold. And that is an opportunity. So they will then put extra, they'll ship extra things. So, they'll release that space to be used for cargo for UPS or whoever else needs to do their shipping. But you have no idea how much of that space is available. And so you also don't know where those flights that they are, where they're going. And so it's hard to plan out the logistics of how to use such a system. So for a while, people didn't have a good policy for this. And so a simple policy might be wait for a plane that's heading in the direction that this item, this product, this shipment is supposed to be going, and then just load it onto that plane and it can piggyback on them, and then it'll hopefully be at least closer and eventually get to its destination. You can do that, but they were curious to see if other things would work. And so they tried a bunch of different with an ABM. With flight routes, simulating all these flight routes over the US, they tried a bunch of different policies where you could say, let's put things on planes that are going the wrong direction, that are going any direction. So, and so and what they found is that if you put them on a plane, if there is a plane going in the right direction, put that package on that plane. But if there are no packages going in the right direction, put them in any plane, just whatever plane connects. Because it's better to get them in the air and wait in the air than wait on the ground. Because most planes that are not going in the right direction will probably be going to a hub. And from a hub, there will almost always be a plane heading in the right direction. So if you happen to be a regional airport waiting for a plane going in the right direction, you're going to wait a huge amount of time. So at that point, just put them on any plane because it's just get them out of this region, this black hole of a region, so that they can get into a hub. Then that helps you have a lot more options. And they found that greatly decreased the time on these packages. And they learned that through ABMs. They learned also a lot about their boarding policies through ABMs. So that's why Southwest, you always see them experimenting with boarding policies because they tried a bunch of things with agent-based models and boarding. And I talked about some of these things earlier, several lectures ago. So I said that your faculty at ASU who've combined the agent-based models and system dynamics models to understand the how disease spreads through the boarding policy. So that's another way that you can sort of see that even if a boarding policy doesn't necessarily change how quickly people get on a plane, it can change how likely it is for a sick person to in fact hold that. They're having a very significant effect. So that's kind of different ways in which we can use it. So any questions on this general idea behind the So before we close, I wanted a couple extra slides that then get that you'll see then in the lab, just to make sure everybody knows what's coming. All right, so in the lab, as you can see, Matt Logo should be on the M111 computers. It's a free program. You all should be able to download it. There's actually web-based versions now that actually run within JavaScript inside a browser. But fundamentally, it was a Java-based platform. Works on Linux, works on Windows, works on Mac. And it allows you to interact with one of these systems, build these systems, and interact with them. So there's a website down here where you can go and download the latest version. I think it's 6.4. It's an NSF-funded project. It's been around forever. Very popular tool to use it. And it has web-based versions ever since 2015. So this is cool because if you build a nature-based model for a stakeholder, you don't have to get them to download that logo. You've got interesting results. You can actually put your result up on the web, and then you can just tell your stakeholder to go to a website, and they'll run the sim inside the web browser. It works on a tablet as well. So it's great if you go to conferences, you want to show off your results, you can just stand there with a tablet, run your sim around. They can't save data out, so they can't load data in. There's some limitations, but if you want to just demonstrate the dynamics of how things work, then it's a much easier way to get to your stakeholders than to tell them to watch a video of you running arenas. So it's a pretty powerful program. This was a colleague did an example here where this was a project funded by NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. So this was a project where they would say, well, if hurricanes are coming to Florida. So this is an example of combining agent-based modeling with geographic information systems, GIS, another hot topic in data science. And so this is a real topographical map of Florida. Underneath it all, there's actually real road systems being modeled here, and there's real populations of people around Florida. And those individuals in Florida are receiving notifications by different modalities in the simulation, TV, social networks, radio, et cetera. And they develop a certain appreciation or trust of those different modalities. So this sim simulates multiple hurricanes that hit Florida. And as the hurricanes coming into the simulated Florida, it then tries different policies out for when to warn people to evacuate, on which modality, and so on. And based on that, then, how do you alter that over time? Or what are the long-term consequences of that? Because what you might find is that if you warn them too early on TV, if they view the TV as a very trustworthy medium, then they're going to view that as like a cried wolf situation, boy who cried wolf, and maybe they will stop trusting that TV as much. So maybe you push out the high uncertainty warnings, like it might get, it might not get. Maybe that goes out on social media first. And then when you're absolutely sure it's going to hit, maybe then it goes out on TV. Because maybe you're willing to sacrifice your social media channel for just in case you did it wrong, but you're not willing to sacrifice that radio channel. So that's what they simulated here. And you could watch these individuals evacuate in real ways. So they would get congested on the Florida roads. So that we could simulate they could evacuate too late, that it's possible to get them out. And you can study things like how often did we get everybody out? How often, what were the problems? All those sorts of things. They studied that all within Met Logo combined with the GIS system. I thought that was kind of a neat idea. So that's another example of things you can do with that. Simpler examples. So this is a standard one that comes packaged with Met Logo. You've got these ants that run around. I don't know if I can bring up, see if I can bring this one up. So this is a kind of a more classic way
to look at NetLogo is to look at complex adaptive systems. And there's a lot of these examples in biology. So I can load up, let me share this. So I can load up into NetLogo this thing called ants as just one example. And so this here is a program that I'm gonna hit setup, and it's going to put together an ant nest in the middle here, and three foraging, three feeders that have food that gets depleted over time. And if I hit go, then what we see is these ants move in a relatively random search path. But as they encounter these food items, then they start laying pheromone trail on the ground. But that pheromone immediately starts to evaporate. So what you're seeing visualized in these heat maps are the concentrations of those pheromones. And as those concentrations are high, they attract ants to them, which bring more ants to the food, which cause them to reinforce that that concentration. So what you end up getting are these search patterns that end up collecting ants to sort of the closest or the best options first, and prioritizing their search so that they start out as a uniform search, but then a targeted search, and then go back to uniform targeting and so on. So there's things we can study about this particular process. And maybe they reveal things that, you know, hypotheses that we can then test on real ants. Or maybe they help us test out strategies that we can use, you know, with robots on Mars that are looking for samples. You can imagine these are decentralized group swarm of robots looking for interesting rocks. Occasionally they find a rock, that rock is too heavy for one to bring back. So it recruits others. They bring it back as a team, but once they bring it back, they have to go back to search. So you can imagine that this can sort of be as a prototype vehicle for things like that. So these are the types of things that we can play with inside NetLogo. Any questions on this model? And I think I'll show this model in the lab as well, but I just wanted to warm us up. All right, so almost finished here.
So, so as you start opening up that logo, things to look for on the page here, you find out that the user interface, these are all things that as a developer, you just drag onto the screen. So you can put sliders on, buttons, switches, menus, all these things are ways in which you can customize the interface. And your agents move around in this arena. You can change the geometry of the arena. There's a 3D version as well, so that you don't have to work on just a plane. So there's a lot of things you can do here, but there is no wiring used like there is in arena. Everything behind the scenes is used in a relatively lightweight programming language. So this is how you pull in all of those different buttons and sliders. There's a tablet or a ribbon up here where you can drag those down. You can adjust the settings of your arena, pull all those things in, design your user interface. And then what's also cool about NetLogo is right on the front is you've got all these buttons and things now. Well, this is great if you want to run one experiment, but what if you want to adjust these parameters? You want to slide them all the way this way or that way. You want to run 10 replications of each. It's really annoying to have to do that over and over and over again by hand. Well, what NetLogo's built, and it turns out Arena has a version of this as well, is something called behavior space. And so under the tools menu in NetLogo, you can go to behavior space, go play with this during the lab, and you can say, I've got a number of different sliders or numeric inputs on my input here. I want to create a set of those that I would like to go through and have you create a full factorial design of an experiment that says every value out of this list gets crossed with every value out of this list. And each one of those gets run this many times. And after for each one of those, I want you to measure these things. And then you hit go, and they'll even distribute it across processors on your machine. So if you've got 20 threads available, so 20 cores available or 20 effective cores available, it will run 20 of these things in parallel to speed up that, and then it will generate a bunch of data that it just dumps out into a spreadsheet for you to analyze afterwards. So we'll see that when you do the lab, we'll experiment with behavior space. So automating these experiments. And Arena has a version of this as well, which you'll see introduced in lab 9 and lab 10. The entities I've mentioned are called turtles, primarily in NetLogo. So these are the agents. So they go off and use the entities that use the term agents in agent-based modeling. There are also patches. So when the ants lay the pheromone on the ground, those ground were stationary agents that their whole job was to hold a concentration and let it decay over time. So they were deciding how to make that decay over time. If they stayed in one place or the ants were moving around, they interacted with each other. So those are two types of entities, the turtles that move around and the patches that stay in one place. And then you can also have links. So you can say that there's two individuals that are linked together, or an individual and a patch are linked together, and the link itself can have its own logic. And so the link can say, who's connected to me right now? Should I interact with them? Should I tell them that because they're connected to each other, a certain event happened and they need to respond in a particular way? So these are the three different types of agents that are constantly interacting with each other in these simulations. Different agents have different attributes by default. Just like in Arena, you can add attributes, but there are default attributes. So every turtle has a breed, has a color, has a head, and so on. Every patch has a X coordinate and a Y coordinate, a color, and so on. And then you can add your own. And links have attributes as well. There are a bunch of pre-built models. In Arena, there's a bunch of pre-built models, but there's way more in NetLogo. So you'll go into the models library in the lab, and you'll grab two of those in particular and play with them in the lab experience. But there's a bunch more that you can drill down into. And if you like the lab, if you enjoy that, I encourage you to take a look at some of these. There's a lot of documentation that comes with each one of those models. So in this little info tab, you can learn how that model works, what are its components, how to use it. Well documented, as with each model. And then you can also then look at the code for each removal model. How is it implemented? And you'll find that it's a relatively simplistic programming language. You can get a very complex output with very little code. So it's kind of cool. One thing that I hope you'll see in the lab that's a little subtle is that most of these programs, like the ants one, they've got a setup which generates all the agents and then a go. And that go is just a button that has been configured that runs a routine inside the code. Like you just create a routine called go, and you say every time that go button's hit, it runs go once. But then you check this little forever, and then the go becomes a button that gets pushed all the way down and stays down until you push it there. That's what makes your agent-based models go in NetLogo. So when you click that go, it's just running whatever this routine is that you've configured on that button over and over and over again. So if you're looking for that, then some of the labs are going to ask you, how do these things work? That's where you need to figure out, like, what's being run over and over again. You look in the go button, you'll be able to figure out what's running over and over again. And here's an example of a go button. I go into this in the lab, so I'm not going to go into some great detail right now. I will highlight in NetLogo, you have this weird ask relationship. So you ask agents to do things, you ask an agent set. So you'll say, ask all turtles to move right now. And that will, each individual turtle will then run its own individual move. But you ask the sets of them to move right. You say, ask all patches to recolor themselves based on their current concentration rate. So we ask things to do things. That's how we interact. You ask sets of things to do things, and then those individuals, parts of those sets, respond by performing whatever you ask them to do. So it's a different way of thinking, but once you get used to it, it's, I think, very natural, but it's very different than when you're programming things in MATLAB or Python or so on, where you're not controlling, you're not saying for I in 1 to number of agents, agent dot x plus one or something like that. You're not doing any of that. You're saying ask all the agents to move the whole set. So you're operating on sets of agents by asking them to do things, what you'll see. There's a great help in NetLogo There's a manuals dictionary, links to users groups, example of the programming guide. You can drill down into see how any of the NetLogo language works. It's very easy to get code examples. There's code examples in the manual. There's also code examples in that models library down at the bottom here. So there's a bunch of examples of how to do things. So it's a very easy language to pick up. It carries with it all the resources that you need to get started. And you can create, but this is the beginning of a, I think it's relatively easy to read. You can say like, oh, there's different breeds of agents. You can say this breed owns these attributes. So it uses language that's meant to sort of be a more natural language as opposed to us talking about attributes and entities inside a reason. So this is stuff that I go over in the lab, but I just wanted to give us a little bit of time to make sure that we all saw it in your lecture as well. So you're going to be working with the segregation model, a famous model that comes from a Nobel Prize winner, as well as the Earth Science Fire model in Lab 4. I'll ask you to do certain things in behavior space, do some analysis with it, maybe a little bit of modification. So that's what we got. It's not you and last four. That's basically what this lecture is for, to bridge the gap between them. Any questions? If not, then your icebreaker for today
is going to be a short answer, and it's what is the term in an agent-based model, what is the term that takes the place of an entity in our discrete event system simulation? So in our DES models, we call them entities. In an agent-based model, what do we call them? So we don't usually use the term entities in an agent-based model. We use a different term in an agent-based model. But otherwise, they play the same role. And that's all I've got for you. So we'll keep it moving on Thursday. Have a good week.